History through the eyes of those who lived it. This is Hometown Heroes, presented on the air and online by Provident Payments, proudly honoring the men and women whose service and sacrifice have secured our freedom. Now, the host of Hometown Heroes, Paul Leffler.
Welcome to another edition of Hometown Heroes, the program that reminds you no matter where you live in this great country of ours, no matter how big or how small your hometown might be, there are stories there that should not go untold. And they don't have to go untold, as long as we're willing to ask a few questions and take the time to listen as powerful memories start to emerge. Our primary goal, of course, to honor our veterans for their service and sacrifice. We want to preserve their stories so we never forget the price that's been paid for our freedom. And along the way, not only are we educated, not only are we entertained, but so often we end up inspired. The holiday we're about to observe is all about inspiration and the power that comes when courageous leaders are willing to speak truth, regardless of how popular it may be at the time. Since our country will pause this week to observe Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. Day, I thought we'd attach that theme to this week's edition of Hometown Heroes as well. Dr. King dreamed out loud about a day when people would be evaluated based on the content of their character and not the color of their skin. One place where I got to see that kind of reality in action recently is Veterans of Foreign Wars Post 10147 in Apopka, Florida. Over the weeks to come, you're going to hear from some of the veterans I had the privilege of meeting there, a diverse group of men and women from a multitude of ethnic backgrounds whose service years spanned from World War II to the Korean War, the Cold War, Vietnam, and even our more recent conflicts in Iraq and Afghanistan. And here they are all working together in 2022 to make their hometown a better place. You're going to get to meet one of them today. She happens to be a retired Army Lieutenant Colonel who's making a difference in the lives of many today through a special nonprofit organization. But the long career she enjoyed in the military may not have been possible without the efforts of Dr. King and his contemporaries, not to mention those who came before. Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. never served in the military, but we've talked about on this program before the fact that some of the people who influenced him the most, like his right-hand man, Ralph Abernathy, had been part of the segregated U.S. military during World War II. Roughly 1 million African Americans served in our armed forces during the war, and you've met quite a few of them here on Hometown Heroes over the years. You've heard them talk about the double V, seeking victory over our enemies abroad, but also over discrimination at home. Some of the courageous stands in that battle on the home front would be credited later for helping pave the way for Dr. King and the civil rights movement. Chief among them was what more than 100 of the famed Tuskegee Airmen decided to do at Freeman Army Airfield near Seymour, Indiana. If you're a longtime listener to Hometown Heroes, you may remember a pilot by the name of Mitch Higginbotham from the 477th Bomb Group explaining a now legendary situation that he experienced firsthand.
At that time, there had been a lot of unrest, racial unrest in the city of Detroit, and race riots had broken out all over Detroit and caused quite a crisis situation. The commanders at Selfridge Field was afraid that all was going to spill over into the military. They had segregated the officers' club there at Selfridge for white officers only, and blacks weren't permitted in the officers' club at Selfridge. Well, as a result of all this, the decision makers in Washington decided that we would had to leave the Detroit area, and there was a field, with a service field available called Godman Field in Louisville, Kentucky. It's adjacent to Fort Knox.
Right.
And it wasn't designed for that type of combat training at all. It was very insufficient, but that's where they relocated the 477th Bomb Group. And, of course, there wasn't a racial problem there because the little officers' club at Godman, they were gladly relegated that to the black officers, because the white personnel, officer personnel, could use the officers' club at Fort Knox, right, and it's approximately across the street. And so there was no problem there until when they found out how inadequate Godman Field, they decided to move the bomber group to Freeman Field near Seymour, Indiana, which is about 40, 50 miles from Indianapolis. And we'd heard about some difficulties there in the officers' club. We had decided then that we couldn't tolerate that situation. And when we arrived there at Freeman, there was a group of some of our fellows thought that they would test entry to the officers' club. And, of course, the commander found out that this was anticipated, and he had designated the provost marshal to be there to see that his segregated orders were carried out. We had decided in pairs of threes or fours, we would go over to test the officers' club. And so that was where trouble began. And
well, you saw trouble coming, didn't you?
Yes, indeed, we did, really. We knew that it was going to be a confrontation, but didn't know what the nature of it would finally end up as. Commander Robert Selway, Colonel Robert Selway, then...
Who was white.
Yes, indeed, he was. And he, acting in collusion with his commander, I guess he was three or four-star general, Hunter was head of the entire 1st Air Force, which we were a part of.
Right.
So Selway ordered the fellows that went into the club there to be arrested. They were placed in house arrest for overnight and the next day. He got the situation formalized then, whereby all of us would be given an opportunity, being interviewed one at a time and being ordered directly to sign papers that we read and understood the orders and would abide by them.
So you basically had to promise not to go into the all-white officers' club again.
Well, it was more than a promise. It was a matter of being individually ordered,
right,
not to use by our immediate commanding officer, and read the articles of war regarding direct orders in time of warfare. And one section which was emphasized was that refusal to obey a direct order in time of warfare was punishable up to and including death. And of course, death was emphasized.
Mm-hmm.
And even in the face of all that, 104 of us refused to sign. There was about, somewhere in the neighborhood of 500 black officers and maybe less than 100 white officers, maybe 85 or so. When the 104 of us refused to sign, General Hunter sent down, we were placed under arrest immediately.
Well, and I want to get into your mindset, because obviously there's strength in numbers, and if 104 of you are doing it, it's maybe a little easier than doing it all by yourself. But
you hit on a good point there.
But where does that
head, so to speak?
Where does that courage come from, though?
Well,
what made you decide I'm not going to sign this?
This is where the difficult situation arose, because we had no idea how many would refuse. And if only a dozen or a half dozen of us refused in the face of the Articles of War, then we would have been out on a limb all alone, and I'm sure that limb would have been sawed off.
Mm-hmm.
It just so happened that on principle we absolutely refused, and not knowing how many would be in our group. If it had been only a few, then, of course, they would have thrown the book at us. But being over 100 black officers in the black newspapers across the country, the Chicago Defender, Amsterdam News in New York, and the Pittsburgh Courier in Pittsburgh, which was the leading black newspaper, the Pittsburgh Courier, and that was read by white officers, and then across some of our white officers as well. But they put pressure, and then we contacted NAACP. Well, first we were flown back
Well, and I want to get all that timeline, but I'm really interested in your personal decision to do this, knowing that they could throw the book at you, that anything could happen up to execution. But you had the courage to stand up and say, this is wrong, I'm not signing this. Where did that come from? How did you arrive at that decision?
Well, I was always incensed by this kind of action. And I was determined, you know, it was a matter of principles that I just couldn't stomach to be a part of something that where, in first place, ordering you to sign your name, I felt was illegal. I didn't know, you know, but I just, from what the education and whatnot that I had, I knew it wasn't right. And I was determined to go by principles. And face the music, so to speak.
No matter what it meant, nothing scared you off.
Well, it didn't. And you look back, we were 20-year-old guys, 21, 20, 19, some of us, and just were determined that, that we wouldn't succumb to that sort of arrangement.
So they arrested you.
They arrested, and General Hunter sent down three C-47s. And they marched us down to the flight lines, and the enlisted men were observing and taking pictures of what was going on with their cameras. And most of the cameras were confiscated, but some of them got through, and they had pictures on the front page of the black newspapers liking the situation to Hitler's actions in Germany.
Mm.
And so I have some copies of the Pittsburgh Courier citing these pictures and citing in the headlines the Gestapo type of operations that was occurring at Freeman Field, Indiana.
Well, that's a pretty powerful comparison, given everything that people had heard about what was happening in Europe.
Indeed. And in our lockup, we contacted them. NAACP and Thurgood Marshall was head of the legal department. The NAACP had agreed to represent us in a court-martial trial. So it was so much pressure. We had some influential black people, the professionals, the parents of many of us, and they applied pressure. The pressures exerted were sufficient to get a change, and they sent down a group of colonels from Washington to investigate the situation, and they investigated in Freeman, and they came down to Godman. We had a fellow named Coleman Young, who later became mayor of Detroit for four terms.
Yeah.
He was one of us, and he was maybe a year or two older than me, for instance. He had some training as a labor leader in the auto workers union there in Detroit. So he had some kind of knowledge, and those kind of pressures eventually ended up in 101 of us being released with letters of reprimand placed in our files, reprimanding us for that type of disobedience. That remained on our records till 1995.
So for 50 years, even though you'd been released, you still had this.
Still had the reprimand on our records of the 101. But the three that were court-martialed, Bill Terry, Marsden Thompson, and Shirley Clinton. Two of the fellows were found not guilty, I guess you'd call it, and one fellow was convicted in the court-martial.
And that was your roommate?
That was my roommate, Bill Terry. Bill Terry was convicted and fined $150.
But in 1995, more than a half century later, he received a full pardon and got his $150 back. The Freeman Field Mutiny, a significant moment on the path towards the integration of our armed forces, and eventually the other developments that we celebrate this week in honor of Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. Again, that voice you heard was from the late Mitch Higginbotham. You can link to his complete original interview at hometownheroesradio.com. Almost all the veterans we've gotten to know on this program served in World War II, but when we come back, you're going to meet a young woman who recently retired with the rank of lieutenant colonel after 30 years in the Army. She'll give us a taste of what today's men and women in uniform go through and also explain how her new mission incorporates some of the most important lessons she learned from her military experience. Hometown Heroes will be right back after this. I always love hearing from listeners, and so many of you tell me you listen to Hometown Heroes while you're on the road. Nobody spends more time on the road than our friends in the trucking business. And if that's your business, I'm sure you know about Central Valley Trailer Repair. If you don't, you really should. Conveniently located near California's major transportation arteries, CVTR has stockpiles of parts waiting for you in Fresno and in Stockton. With experienced service technicians ready to handle even the most difficult of repairs. Central Valley Trailer Repair is an authorized Great Dane sales, parts, and service center, and you can always find a huge inventory of new and used semi-trailers for sale too. Dry freight, refrigerated, flatbed, whatever you're looking for, CVTR has you covered. How about 24-hour emergency service? You bet. What can't CVTR help you with? That's a question I can't answer, so you'll have to ask them yourself at 1-800-877-8444. That's 1-800-877-8444. The website, that's simple, cvtr.com, for Central Valley Trailer Repair, and tell them you heard about them on Hometown Heroes. When life throws you curveballs, you have to be adaptable, or at least have a good pinch hitter on the bench who knows how to handle a curve. When it comes to your business, Provident Payments is the best teammate you could ever have. Perhaps it helps that many of the leaders for one of the fastest-growing payment consultants in America are former ballplayers. Contactless payments, online ordering, point of sale, you name it, Provident Payments knows it. Now, you could get some of these services from one of the big banking companies, but you're never going to get the kind of personalized service that Provident Payments delivers every day. 24/7 solution-based tech support. When your ability to process payments goes haywire in any way, time is money. So would you rather wait on hold for who knows how long, or would you like to have a direct line you can call for immediate help? That's where a good teammate comes in. Learn more about bringing Provident Payments onto your team at providentpayments.com. They really are one of the fastest-growing payment consultants in America. That website again, providentpayments.com.
Proudly presented by Provident Payments, this is Hometown Heroes, celebrating everyday Americans who answer the call of duty.
You can come up to the end of the building. You see a man grappling with the problem of the bankruptcy of his nation. Come with an eloquent cry that we have nothing to fear but fear itself. But I wouldn't stop there. Strangely enough, I would turn to the Almighty and say, if you allow me to live just a few years in the second half of the 20th century, I will be happy.
That is Dr. Martin Luther King Jr., the famed I've Been to the Mountaintop speech delivered in Memphis just prior to his assassination in 1968.
And I see God working in this period of the 20th century in a way that men in some strange way are responding. Something is happening in our world.
A lot has happened since those words were proclaimed nearly 54 years ago now. Yolanda Frazier was just a toddler then. Her parents likely could never have envisioned the path that she would carve through the Army in a 30-year career that came with deployments overseas, sometimes heart-wrenching assignments, and positions of great responsibility. Before we're done, you're going to hear about the nonprofit she's running now, Enough International. I have that linked for you at hometownheroesradio.com. But sitting in the spacious hall of VFW Post 10147 in Apopka, Florida, Yolanda made it clear that while she didn't initially intend to join our armed forces, military service is in her DNA.
a military brat. I was born in Harrisburg, Pennsylvania. My father was stationed there. And then we moved to Yarra Linda, California. And then from later after that, we moved to Biloxi, Mississippi, where he was stationed at Keesler Air Force Base. So my father retired Air Force. I have two other brothers that were also in the Air Force and another brother in the Army. And so I was around all of these military veterans. And of course, during that time, I was not thinking about going into the military. I was a journalism major. I have an associate degree in journalism, bachelor of science degree in radio, television, and film. I was supposed to be on CNN somewhere. And somehow another, and went to the University of Southern Mississippi, USM, and ROTC was just awesome. I love the discipline. I love the structure. And so I actually got in the ROTC as an elective. Had no idea. They were just like, just totally hooked me and reeled me in. And so next thing I know, I end up joining. And it was the greatest decision I ever made for my career.
And 30 years in the military, I'm sure you saw the military itself change a little bit over that time. And I'm thinking specifically to women in the military, you probably saw a fair amount of change.
Yes, definitely. When I first joined, actually joined in 1987, my first duty assignment was Fort Huachuca, Arizona. They used to call it Fort We Gotcha. Fort McCullen, which is the area of the WAC. And also, I was an NBC officer, nuclear biological chemical officer. And so starting off in the military, at that time, women did not go into combat. And of course, things have evolved tremendously since then. So there was a lot of things during my career I actually saw evolved. You had the don't ask, don't tell. And just a list of things have totally changed tremendously based on what you see now in the military and what I actually observed and experienced when I first came in.
What are some of the things that you really appreciated about your time in the military, and maybe what are some of the challenges that you faced?
Some of the things I really appreciated was being able to have that family camaraderie in the military. Being an officer, we were trained early that our non-commissioned officers trained us. And so having those individuals, those senior non-commissioned officers, basically show us the ropes. They showed us how to be strategic leaders, transformational leaders, visionary leaders, and they also gave us examples of how not to be toxic leaders. And so that was something that really weighed heavy on my heart, because they taught us about character, about integrity, about leading by example. So it's not just what I say, but how I live my life. Being a very strong advocate for Jesus Christ and having those morals and values from being raised that way basically just overwhelmed me in the military also, because so many times in your military career, you find yourself in situations and circumstances where you're going to have to call on something bigger and greater than yourself, right? And so those foundational aspects of morals and values just were things that I carried close and dear to me. But having those good non-commissioned officers that would pull us to the side and say, look, this is how you shouldn't be as a leader. These are things that to be a good leader that you're going to have to maintain and carry with you, because it's not just what you say as a soldier, but it's how you conduct your life, because soldiers are always not only listening to you, but watching the things that you do.
What are some examples of some of the assignments you had, some of the places that you got sent, some of the difficult tasks that you had to carry out?
So one of the most refreshing and rewarding positions I had was a TAC officer. And so as a TAC officer, you have two non-commissioned officers that work with you, TAC NCOs, and you train second lieutenants right out of college. And so oftentimes, even when I was a second lieutenant, I used to think I was getting picked on. And you know, it was like they're just calling me out, right? But the realistic aspect about it was that my TAC officer saw different leadership qualities in me. And lo and behold, as time went on, after I left Fort Huachuca, Arizona, I ended up going to Fort McCullen. And as a captain, I was a TAC officer training second lieutenants. And believe it or not, when you're there training those young minds, right, they're getting that first opportunity outside of ROTC to get an experience of what the Army's going to be like and how they can be leaders to affect the other leaders that they're going to actually be over. Because oftentimes, as a young officer, you are leading non-commissioned officers that are more experienced and much older than you are. And so to be able to train them that when you go into these organizations, whether you're a platoon leader or a captain or whatever your rank is, being humble enough to be able to learn from others that are around you that have more knowledge and experience. And so being able to share those attributes and those aspects with these young officers and being able to challenge them to be better individuals, because sometimes you think joining the military, you know, they do break you down and bring you back up under their guidance and their morals, their values, their standards and requirements that the Army has. But guess what? You're still an individual. You're still going to be challenged to think for yourself and make those challenging decisions, right? That's going to set you apart from others. And so being a TAC officer was one of those awesome opportunities. And it was very interesting. You know, I'm a very humble person, always happy. But sometimes especially when it came down to life and death, I had young officers, one in mine that was from Citadel, and he was about 6'4", and I'm standing up there correcting him and having him stand in the position of attention, because it was just that important. Because one day, the things that you do or don't do can either save a life or lead someone to a conversation that you have to have with their parents because you were not doing the things that you were supposed to be doing as a leader. So after leaving Fort McCullen, and right before I finished talking about Fort McCullen, I had a chance to go into the live chemical chamber. That was a mind-opening experience to make sure that the full MOP gear that we wore was actually proven that we could trust the MOP gear, right? And that was something that being a chemical officer was really an eye-opening experience, because as any of us can probably allude to go through a gas chamber is something you'll never forget. And so being that officer to tell people to come on in here, you're going to stand, you're going to break your seal, you're going to check your protective mask, right? So when we talk about wearing a mask for COVID, I'm like, that's a piece of cake compared to the things that we used to have to wear and have to wear it that long, right? So I'm leaving Fort McCullen. You know, I had a gap in service where I was in the reserves at Camp Shelby for a period of time. And then when I got back in service, they had a program called Recalls for Active Duty. And I came back in as an officer again. And that's where I went to Fort Bliss, Texas, and enjoyed Fort Bliss, Texas. Air Defense Artillery. I was in Air Defense Artillery Brigade, 11th Brigade, and then also as a commander there as well. I had 300 soldiers from the general all the way down to the private. Awesome, awesome command. The challenge there, they never had a female in that position. You know, I am dealing with the aspect of being two minorities, not only a female, but also an African-American female in the service. And so at times there would be challenges. I remember being at Fort Leavenworth in school, and I remember having to get up and do a presentation. Our TAC officer was field artillery. He was not used to being around females. Most of his units were all males. And I remember getting up and giving my presentation. And I had studied, and, you know, I was had all my PowerPoint slides and everything was dressed right, dressing in order. And after I gave my presentation, he looked at me, and instead of talking about the areas in my presentation that I could have improved on, that I could have done better, he started talking about my tone of voice and my dialect and said, well, I know that you're from the South, and just started going up one side and down the other, just really just tearing me down. And I can remember thinking in my mind that a certain percentage of our grade was basically based on interaction and communicated in class. But I remember walking back to my quarters and thinking to myself, I don't want to participate in class anymore. And I remember in my mind, I remember actually praying to God about it. And this was right before 9/11 hit, because that's where I was, at Fort Leavenworth at the time. And I remember in my mind saying to myself, I can do two things. Either I can let this individual shut me down, or I can overcome this challenge. And I remember opening the Bible and seeing the verse where God said, vengeance are mine, saith the Lord. And I said, you know what? This is his problem, not my problem. And later on, I think within a week, we had to do surveys where you had to basically rate your instructor, and then you had to do peer surveys on how we interacted with one another in the classroom. My TAC, he was a lieutenant colonel, called me in his office. And at that time, my last name was Malik. And he said, Captain Malik, it was brought to my attention by your peers that they did not appreciate how I talked to you and how I literally really degraded you in class the other day. And he said, I want to go in front of the class and apologize. And in my spirit, I was going, yes. But in my heart of heart, I said, sir, I said, if this isn't your apology to me right now, I accept it. You don't have to go in front of the class to do that. And it was just refreshing, because I was like, God, you answered my prayer, you know. And so I've learned that it's imperative that it's important to treat people the way we want to be treated. The challenges of being a female in the military, especially with family and children. So I remember as a TAC officer at Fort McClellan, Alabama, we were out on a mission out in the field. And I remember being in my tent as an officer, and the TAC officer, I had my tent by myself. And I remember my non-commissioned officer tapping my outside of my tent saying, "Ma'am, you're ready. Are you ready?" You know, and I'm like, "I'm getting dressed. I'll be out there in a minute." And I remember tears welling up in my eyes because I know this is somewhat personal, but I had a hand breast pump and I'm literally pumping my breast in the field, pouring my breast milk, which is like, if anybody understands, breast milk is like liquid gold, you know, and I'm literally like pouring it on the ground. And then another time, at a time in my life, in my career, when I was a single mother, I have three children, and I just went to, I got stationed at Fort Bliss, Texas, and I had not completed my family care package yet. And we were supposed to go on this big field exercise. It was called Roving Sands out at Fort Bliss, Texas. And I had gotten invited to a church, and I remember sitting at the church another time where tears swelled up in my eyes because I was like, I got to go to the field for almost 2 weeks, and I know no one who is going to watch my children. You know what I'm saying? And so I was blessed to actually meet a warrant officer, and she's like, "Hey, I have three kids. I'm a single mom. I'll watch your children for you." But it's those times when, you know, I don't know how a lot of people get through what they get through, but I attribute to all my military career with God being my foundation, Him being that source where He provided and opened doors and windows and gave me favor and heard my heart and heard my secret prayers where you're pillow is wet at night, and then the next day, what you worried and stayed up all night, and the next day it didn't even happen. You know what I'm saying? It's like, oh my God, you know, why did I, you never fail me. You're faithful. Even sometimes when man is not faithful, God has just been faithful and keeps doing that over and over again, where when the enemy tells you and tries to mess with your mind and saying, you can't do this. And then you go back to that list and you're like, no, he did this. He did this. He did this. He did this. You know what I mean? And you just rejoice in your heart that he's got you again. You know, he showed up again. Those are just times in my career where he's been so, so faithful with me during my career with my family and my children. And like I said, a lot of people that I've met throughout my life and the career, they're like, how are you so happy? How are you so, you know, at peace? And I credit all that to having that relationship with Jesus, not just knowing and hearing about him, but personally knowing him to be that anchor for me through all that craziness that I've experienced and seen. But he was the anchor that got me through. And then another opportunity I had when I was a cadet, actually, and I was stationed in a unit, you only have a small segment of time to go eat. And I remember going to the shop bed and I asked a fellow cadet, I said, do you want me to pick up you anything? And he said, yeah, just get me some Vini sauces, some crackers and grape juice. You know, we only had a short period of time to eat. So I asked another cadet Brumfield, I never forget. I said, do you want me to pick you up anything? No, you don't need to get me anything. So the young cadet that asked me to grab him something, I grabbed his food and I came back and I saw that cadet Brumfield. And I said, will you go take him his food? He said, sure. So a little bit of time had passed, and the soldier, young cadet that I actually bought the food for, he said, where's my food? He said, I gave you the money, where's my food? And I said, well, I gave it to Cadet Brumfield. And we found Cadet Brumfield up against a cut V eating this other cadet's food. Needless to say, I was livid. So I went to Cadet Brumfield and I just chewed him up. I mean, I just went off on him like, how dare you? I even asked you if you wanted some food and you said no. And I said, had you wanted some, I would have bought, but how dare you eat this other cadet's food? And at the time, in my I'm seeing red, literally going off on this soldier, a first lieutenant called me and said, Cadet, I was a Quinn at the time. That was my maiden name. He said, Cadet Quinn, Cadet Brumfield, and the other cadet, he said, come here right now. And he took us behind the cut V. He said, what are you doing? And I said, he was wrong. I explained the whole story to him. He said, look, he said, you had the right idea, but it was the wrong method. He said, when you all were out here arguing at one another, all these non-commissioned officers had stopped eating and they were watching you all. And he said, what you should have done, if you had a problem with him, you should have called him to the side behind the vehicle and you should have expressed yourself. He said, so you may have won the battle, but you lost the war. And so that was all these times through my military career. I've had times where not only did I do that to someone by showing them, hey, look, it may have been the right, you were totally right in how you felt about what you saw, an injustice or thing that you may have seen. mean, but in the it was the way that you have to do it. You know what I mean? The word tells us that with love, kindness are they drawn. And so there are times that we had to make an example. And there's also times where you give people teachable opportunities to show them a way in saying, hey, so-and-so, come here. Let me show you the right way to do this, you know? And so those are the things I've learned so much from the military.
It's time for our final break, but there's much more to come with retired Lieutenant Colonel Yolanda Frazier, including some of the most difficult and most emotional assignments the Army ever gave her, a glimpse into a tragic scene during her deployment in Afghanistan, but also the hope she carries as she seeks to educate, empower, and encourage through her nonprofit, Enough International. Hometown Heroes will be right back after this. Do you ever have those moments where you realize you've been settling for less than the best for far too long? Sometimes we just accept the status quo without looking around for better ways to do things. And I've got to tell you, when it comes to your money, I believe I found a better way with EECU. Take a look at myeecu.org and you'll see why. EECU is not a bank. It's a nonprofit credit union that's all about taking care of you, the member. That's one of the reasons EECU just keeps growing and growing. Close to 300,000 members now in 10 different California counties. Over 30,000 ATMs, free mobile banking. And what I really love is how EECU always goes above and beyond to serve the community. In 2013, the leadership and generosity of EECU helped establish Central Valley Honor Flight. More than 1,000 veterans now have gotten to see their memorials in Washington, D.C. for free. And that's just one example of the community involvement EECU takes oh so seriously. Pick up the phone and become a member today. 1-800-538-3328. That's 800-538-3328. Let's try a little experiment here. I'm going to say a common three-word phrase, and I want you to pay attention to what kind of reaction it produces for you. You ready? Here we go. Buying a car. Okay, be honest, did you tense up a little? If so, I don't blame you. Buying a car can be really stressful, and I've got three more words for you to make sure you do get it right. You ready? Farney Automotive Group. We recently went looking for our daughter's first car, and I made a beeline for Selma because I knew my friends at Farney Ford, Farney Buick GMC, and Toyota of Selma were people I could trust. Trust is a very important word when it comes to buying a car. And here's my advice. Regardless of what kind of vehicle you're looking for, start your search at Toyota of Selma because you can check out their wall of honor with group photos from every single Central Valley Honor Flight. Over 1,300 veterans who have their pictures on the wall there and also got a free oversized group photo from their trip to D.C. thanks to the generosity of the Farney Automotive Group. So new or used, big or small, start your car search today at Toyota of Selma. You can't miss it on the west side of the 99 at the Floral Avenue exit. And don't leave without visiting that wall of honor.
Honoring veterans from sea to shining sea. You're listening to Hometown Heroes with Paul Leffler. Brought to you by this local station and its sponsors. And presented everywhere, on the air and online, by Provident Payments. One of the fastest growing payment consultants in America. Connect today at providentpayments.com.
Welcome back to Hometown Heroes and an episode that I hope adds a little context from the past, the present, and the future to that special day we mark each and every year in America in honor of Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. We heard about the Freeman Field Mutiny in World War II from one of those brave Tuskegee Airmen who took a stand, and how episodes like that during the campaign for the Double V helped fuel Dr. King and the Civil Rights Movement in the years that followed. And now, thanks to VFW Post 10147 in Apopka, Florida, and one of its newer members, retired Army Lieutenant Colonel Yolanda Frazier, we're hearing an example of someone whose journey fulfills some of Dr. King's vision as she tries to bring help, hope, and healing to others today.
A lot of my time is spent with people from the World War II generation. It was not an all-volunteer military then. There were a lot of them that were drafted into it, whether they wanted to be or not. But you served in an all-volunteer military. You supervised a lot of men and women.
serving because they wanted to. What should we know about those young men and women who have served in Iraq and Afghanistan and some of these more recent conflicts that I don't personally hear as much about?
I was in an organization called RDCOM, and their primary goal was to bring science, technology, and engineers into the battlefield, into the war zone. Reason is, oftentimes, as an later on in my career, I was an acquisition officer, so we're working with Raytheon, Lockheed Martin, all these huge, huge companies and corporations building devices and systems for the soldiers. And we really don't realize that although you can do a lot of the science and technology inside of nice air conditioned facilities and everything works great, it's only when you take it in the actual environment in which it's going to be utilized by a soldier do you find problems and you need to take them back to the program manager to fix them. So the particular unit I was in, the goal of that unit was to bring the science and technology into theater. So if you had a problem with a military weapon, maybe it's the M16 or MRAP vehicle or whatever, those scientists can actually do a video of it and be able to fix it and then take it back to the companies to refit or retrain or whatever that problem is, right? Go back to the actual engineers to refabish whatever the problem is. So long story short, when I was over there, I went over there 3 times because we were trying to build this facility over there to start bringing these engineers in to fix a lot of the problems and issues that we may have been seeing. But long story short, I recall going over there and it was very, very interesting. Oftentimes, even in some situations, every time the sirens would go off, we'd have to run into these bunkers. And I can remember a time, sometimes when the sirens would go off, it would just not be feasible for me to run to the bunker. And so it really challenged your faith, who you really believed in. I remember one time the siren went off and you're supposed to put on your full battle rattle, your Kevlar and all your gear and run to the bunker. And I was in the shower. And I remember thinking to myself, naked I came into the world, naked I go out, because there was no way I could get out of there fast enough to run to the bunker. I recall one time there was a big meeting of a lot of the senior leaders and civilians that were over there, civilians on the battlefield that were over there, DOD civilians, employees, and one of the fellow Afghans that we had actually trusted had taken a grenade and rolled it into the conference room, killing several, not only our fellow military soldiers, but also DOD civilians that were over there. And I remember going into the chow facility. And a fellow soldier was sitting there, and he had his weapon turned around, turned upside down, and he was sitting there. And, I mean, tears were just flowing from his face. His whole T-shirt was saturated. And I sat there trying to eat my breakfast, and I remember looking at him. And I told my sergeant major that I was with, I said, I need to go over there and talk to that soldier now. And I went over there, and I said, soldier, I said, what's going on? And he said, ma'am, why are we here? He said, ma'am, I don't understand. We've been in this war too long. Why are we here? They don't want us here. We're trying to come over here, you know, and change their mindset of whether they're opium, you know, with opium fields. We're trying to restructure their environment, their whole land, and teach them a better way, ma'am. But they're still killing us, and I don't know why we're here. Needless to say, there was nothing that I could really do to encourage this soldier because his mind was set, because one of those individuals that it was in that conference room was one of his battle buddies that had died. And he actually had encouraged him to reenlist and stay over there to do another tour that they can come back to the States together. And so what do you do with that? And so time after time after time, I would sit down and talk to soldiers, pick their brains, hear their hearts with a lot of things that they were observing that they did not feel, you know, because they were committed to serve, they were loyal to serve. But what do you do when a fellow soldier in that particular situation lose their best friend and their battle buddy, and we kind of just scoot them along? You know, dig deep, you got this, and just keep pushing them, pushing them, pushing them through. And so oftentimes, even myself, when I went to the VA and they said, hey, you know, do you have post-traumatic stress syndrome? And at first you kind of say no, right? But then when you come back from theater and you sit down in a dining facility and you're kind of observing, you're always watching. Sometimes you're used to having a 9mm on your pocket and you're like feeling for your weapon. Everything is suspect, you know? And so you find yourself that you do need to sit down oftentimes and have those conversations. And then when you also come back, whether it was the Vietnam era that my father served in, or even coming back from Afghanistan, you still see a lot of fellow soldiers in need. And you're like, okay, society, what are we doing? You know what I'm saying? They sacrificed. They gave up their life. Their family actually served too. So even being a casualty assistance officer and notification officer, which was a humbling honor for me, you know, being that person to knock on the door and go and sit down and talk to that family member and saying that your family loved one is now was killed in combat, or being that assistant officer, you're helping them from the time they get their SGLI check to helping with all the funeral arrangements, whether it's an Arlington Cemetery or a cemetery right here in the state of Florida, being there for those family members who now have incorporated you into their family, and speaking at the Gold Star family events and hearing those hearts of fellow soldiers and their families. Those are times that remind us why we served our country, why we do what we do. And it's, you know, sometimes I don't think that society as a whole understands the true sacrifices. They see us in spurts of the things that we did, right? And they get excited about it. But they do, you know, it's really different when you really walk in someone's shoes, right? And so oftentimes, whether I went to Korea, Frankfurt, Germany, Ramsheim, Germany, Hawaii, actually, all over the place, Fort Bliss, Texas, Fort Gordon, Georgia, it doesn't really matter. The family that you have when you're in the military is so, so, so important. And they love you for just who you are. And that's so, so awesome.
I feel like you're going to have a good answer for this. No pressure. But for those of us in the civilian world that, as you said, often can be out of touch with what military families and veterans are going through, how can we best support those people, those families you were just talking about?
I think one of the main things is listening, being there to listen. We don't have enough volunteers oftentimes that can support our fellow veterans, being able to listen and hear their hearts. You know, I have a nonprofit myself, and oftentimes I don't go in trying to check the box and do what I want to do. Say, yes, I did this. But go in and say, how can I help you? What are your needs? Where can I meet you right there where you are? And sometimes just spending that quality time with someone, just sitting there and listening to them. Sometimes it may be giving them a ride to the grocery store. Maybe it is going in there with them to the VA to help them communicate, you know, what the doctor is just rattling off. This is this. They go to this doctor. And, you know, we do a great job. I actually go to the Lake Nona VA because they give you all the list of your meds. But in my hometown where my parents are, they may see a VA doctor here and a civilian doctor here, and none of them are in tune with they're taking this med and they're taking this med, then the meds clash, and the next thing I know, my mom's passed out or my dad's passed out because nobody's there to be that voice for them. And so I think one of the main things is we have a lot of programs, but there's that missing link. And that's when, you know, the military had acquisition. They thought it was vital that the military has all these specs and what their needs are, and the acquisition officer is that go-between between the military and the civilian world. So what is our go-between for us as veterans with the civilian world? Who, you know, having more people that are our voice, our advocate, those people that are cheering us on, but also there also to sit down and say, what do you need? Not what I want to give you, but what do you really, really need?
And you mentioned your nonprofit, and sprinkled throughout all your comments, we hear, you know, life lessons that you learned in the military. I have a feeling that some of those are being applied to this nonprofit. Tell me about the nonprofit, what your aim is, and what it's all about.
So the nonprofit is called Enough. One of the things I realize over my life is people just don't know what you don't know. When we are not educated, the Bible actually says, my people are destroyed for the lack of knowledge. Oftentimes people make bad decisions because they don't have good knowledge, they don't have good information. And so then you make those bad decisions and they just multiply one after the other. My nonprofit is called Enough International because I did see, no matter what country or place I visited, a lot of the foundational problems, it doesn't matter what your race is, it doesn't matter your gender or, you know, your economic status. Some of the same life skill challenges are throughout, no matter what the country or what the environment. So Enough International is based on a 3E concept: education, empower, and encouragement. So we see individuals that are struggling because they're not educated about what services may be out there, the reasons why they made the bad decisions, where did it come from, why have you been doing it this way, and you want to stop and say, okay, let's assess your present situation and how can we help? How can we network you with the right organizations, those areas that you have these gaps gaps and understanding why you've been making those bad decisions. Then the empowerment. You know, we can teach, we can fish for people all day, but it's teaching them how to fish. So those areas where you've received education, whether it's in life skills, whether it's individuals that go and do domestic violence and abuse, human and sex trafficking, life skills where you have challenges in dysfunctional family situations, addictions, homelessness, whatever the case may be. Once you get that education, now I need to empower you. In other words, sitting down and making a strategic plan, you know, with goals and objectives. I don't set the goals and objectives. The individual sets the goals and objectives. Teaching them how to be accountable and responsible for the decisions that they make, but also a plan. You know, when they told me when I was a young lieutenant, make a five-year plan, I laughed. 5 years? 5 years go by very, very quickly. And when you write that plan down, then you start looking at, okay, what are those things that are milestones or goals that I need to do to help meet those particular plans that I've put in place? Not only just for yourself, but also for your family. Also your children, right? And so then we want to empower them. We've encouraged them, we empower them, but now I want to encourage them. I want to provide mentoring, coaching, networking them with other organizations that can have, really help them. And so our organization, we partner with other nonprofit organizations, the Christian Sharing Center, Color Me Confident. Christian Sharing Center main goal is to help homelessness. They provide showers, haircuts, they help them wash their clothes, feel so much better about themselves. Also, the Color Me Confident, we go into inner city schools, talk to young girls there, teach them about leadership, young men as well, leadership, about a lot of things that I learned in the military. I'm able to bring that over and speak to our younger people about those issues. Act to Act, they help love on foster families, foster children, as well as those individuals coming out of human sex trafficking, which in Florida, we're the third in the nation in human sex trafficking. And so being able to partner with other organizations, one organization cannot do it by itself, but being able to help and work with other organizations arm in arm, we can walk through our society to be able to help and reach those in need. We have organizations that do a lot of these things on their own. But so we say, well, hey, you're able to give them monetary things, whether it's Uber cards, whether there's clothing, whether it's baby diapers. But our organization, through Enough International, we work with the mind and the heart, right? Why do you make those decisions? How can you come out of those situations where you may have been a victim, but you still can't no longer have a victim mentality? This past year in 2021, we had two events. One was When a Queen Speaks, understanding and working with young ladies who lost hope, don't see their value, don't see their worth. We have young ladies who are cutting themselves, young individuals dealing with a lot of mental depression at a young age, right? I used to eat ice cream and cry and, you know, date another guy. Now if a guy, you know, doesn't like a girl through bullying on social media and all those trauma and challenges. In October, we had an event called The Mask. When the mask comes off, the healing can begin. I'm a survivor from abuse and physical and mental abuse in my first marriage. My husband was Muslim and I was a Christian, had no idea that those two is like water and oil. They didn't mix, right? But I wanted what I wanted and I got the consequences of that choice. Some relationships like that may work, but mine didn't. So The Mask was talking about being transparent, taking that mask off. And so we were able to bless Harbor House. We had a lot of domestic violence survivors in the room. And so each year we try to do an event. The Mask event was actually here, right here at the VFW. June of this year, we're having a fashion show, helping individuals feel confident and knowing how beautiful and valuable they are. And then later on in the year, we're going to have an event for human and sex trafficking, a panel of experts from Advent Health's emergency room that sees a lot of human and sex traffic victims, the police department, human and sex trafficking victim survivors. And so we need to bring more awareness about the things that we see in our society, not put a Band-Aid on a hand grenade wound, but deal with them, peel off the Band-Aid, and let's be able to talk to those individuals that have experienced that, learn from them, and often bringing simulation is one of those opportunities. I want each experience to not just be a PowerPoint presentation. So simulation is able to bring enactments where people are able to be drawn in to see it eye to eye and be immersed into these events. And that's what we bring with through Enough International.
I have that website for Yolanda's nonprofit, Enough International, linked for you at hometownheroesradio.com. You can also go directly there at enough, the number 3, then the letter E, enough3e.org. Thank you so much for sharing your unique story with us. Is there anything else you think we ought to know?
I just want to say thank you. Thank you for taking out the time. I saw you really engage and listening to the heart of my fellow veterans and individuals like you get the word out. Our stories are so, so valuable. And we all have a story of challenges and also triumphs, of heartache and things that we go through. And just being able to capture our stories really mean a lot to us. And so I appreciate that. And I applaud you for doing that. And I salute you for doing that.
A privilege and a pleasure and a really educational hour. I trust it was for you at home as well, but we're out of time. Thank you so much for listening to Hometown Heroes today. I'm Paul Leffler, reminding you again of that axiom that was true during World War II, and as Yolanda Frazier's memories underscored, is true when it comes to our men and women in uniform today. The price that they pay, visible and invisible, is a heavy one. Freedom is not free.
To let Paul know about a veteran in your life, visit hometownheroesradio.com and click on Suggest a Veteran. Today's program has been brought to you by Provident Payments. Give your business the edge only their personalized service can deliver at providentpayments.com.